Hello everyone, and welcome to the last Labor of Hercules. This one is Pisces. It's the 13th one because we started with an intro first. And I'd like to thank the folks that I've got with me on the staff. For those of you who don't know me, my name is actually not Michael Robbins. I'm using his program, but I am B.L. Allison, okay? So, one of the first things, I don't think we have a problem with it, is making sure everyone is on mic and speakers. It looks to me like everybody is, so we're good to go there. And then the other thing is the noise protocol slides that I had on for the last few minutes. We're going to keep you muted unless we know you have a question and we purposely unmute you, but I would also like you to keep yourself muted. And you can mute and unmute yourself by touching either of the microphones. In your little control panel, you're going to have one microphone here and another little microphone here. Okay, and you touch either one of them and it will mute or unmute you. Also, when you have a question, and I'm going to pause at the end of each slide for questions, but if you have a question, please raise your hand. This is where your hand is right here. See, it's a little hand and it's got a little arrow in it. The arrow is going to point in the direction that you want to go. In other words, if you've got a green up arrow, it means that your hand is down now and you have the opportunity to put it up. If you have a red down arrow, it means your hand is up and you have the opportunity to put it down. To make sure that everybody understands this and has that working properly, I'd like to see everybody raise their hands right now, please. I didn't get all of them, but I got a considerable number. I hope the rest of you have got it. It's right here. This is where you raise it. And it's just the same as the other one. You touch it again with the down arrow, and it will go back down again if you'll put them back down again. Okay. Another way of notifying us, if you haven't figured out where your hand is or you can't find your hand, there we go. You can type a message to us. See, there's a little chat button. If you've got a little plus sign there, what you want to do is click it to make it a minus sign, and it's going to open up this little chat box. You can just type in a message here, and me or my helpers will watch for that. You can either say something or you can say, hey, I can't raise my hand, or I'm having trouble, or I don't see my hand, or whatever, and we can try and work with you either behind the scenes or, you know, ask a question normally. Some of you may not have a headset or may have problems with other things, and it may just be easier for you to use the chat box than it is to raise your hand and talk. Okay? So I think we're good for that. This is, of course, the Labors of Hercules, an astrological interpretation, and it's based on articles that Alice Bailey printed. Well, there were lectures that she gave, and then those lectures were printed in the Beacon newsletter that she published between 57 and 58, and then that was compiled together into the book. Great little book. We've covered a lot of it, and as we've gone through it, I've sent out the particular labor for each one. But, and that is available, the labors are available at various different places on the internet as pages, but I haven't actually seen an electronic copy of the book anywhere. You need to get the hard copy of the book because there's some really interesting things in the preface to the book and also in the end of the book that aren't just covered by the individual labors. I've tried to put that into my slides and discuss that every month as we've gone through this. But it's just a wonderful little book. It's not that big, and I highly recommend that everybody get it if they don't already have it. And here's why. I've emphasized this many times before. This particular slide, I alternated with this one and another one throughout most of these webinars, just because it's well worth repeating. The progress of a disciple is demonstrated for us by Hercules and his path through the zodiac. But progress isn't just about disciples. It's applicable to all of us and helping us to understand the lessons of every sign, whether we have that sign strongly within our own charts or are just influenced by transiting or progressed planets. Every chart has every single sign, some better represented than others, some we wish weren't quite so represented, but that's what we live with. That's the lessons that we brought with us this life. Okay, now, there was a question last week, and it was a two-parter, and I really only answered the last part because I wanted to save the first part for this final time here. The question was Hercules a real person or just a myth? You know, we talk about him as if he were a real person. The ancient wisdom leads us to believe that actually all myths are based on an inner truth, although over the ages that has become distorted and the truth, the little kernel of truth within it, may actually be unrecognizable in a lot of them. But in my humble opinion, it doesn't really matter, because the archetype, that blueprint of the person discussed in the myth or how they act, that's what is really important, and that rings true. This is a thought form that has been built up and perpetuated for a very long time. These myths come to us from, these particular ones, from the Greek and Roman traditions, but they're based on even earlier myths, and there's a line of similarities that you can trace to almost all nationalities and ethnic backgrounds. And the truth of the lesson that we learn from these myths is also very real. So whether your inner truth tells you that that it's a myth or a man, Hercules's lesson is still very valid. But was he actually real? I personally try and think that he is, but then again, you know, I'm a very optimistic person. I'm always the glass half full type. But I also want to tell you that DK talks about him in the Blue Books, and that's in several books, not just one, as if he were a real person. In fact, there's this great passage from Destiny of Nations that I want to read to you. Other and earlier sons of God presented diverse divine qualities and attributes, but in three of them a certain perfection of presentation was achieved, which, as far as this present world period is concerned, can never be surpassed. These three are Hercules, the perfect disciple but not yet the perfected son of God, the Buddha, the perfect initiate having reached illumination but not yet having developed to perfection all the attributes of divinity, and then the Christ, the absolutely perfect expression of divinity for this cycle, and therefore the teacher alike of angels and of men. That ahead of the race may lie a still higher perfection that attained by any of these three exponents is inexpressibly true, for we know not yet what divinity really means. In these three, however, we have three instances of a perfection which lies far ahead for the majority of the sons of men. In all of them, the sixth and second rays were controlling factors, with the first ray reaching full expression. In them, idealism, love, wisdom, indomitable will stood forth in all their divine power. It might be interesting to know just what rays controlled these sons of God. Hercules, the sun god, had a first-ray soul, a second-ray personality, and a sixth-ray astral body. These potencies and energies suffice to carry him through all the trials and the labors of the disciple. The Buddha had a second-ray soul, a first-ray personality, and a sixth-ray mind. That was a very rare phenomenon, that sixth-ray mind. The Christ had a second-ray soul, a sixth-ray personality, which accounted for his close relationship with the Master Jesus, plus a first-ray mind. So see how all three of those played with them, but in different order, different purposes of the vehicles that they carried those rays on. These three all embodied the essences of the spiritual life, and all of them were enabled to set their seal upon history and upon the hearts of men, largely through the potency of their sixth-ray expression. All of them embodied also the new spiritual impulse which their day and age required. And all of them, for centuries, by the strength of their living love and power, brought the vision and the aspiration of humanity back to those spiritual essentials whereby men must live. I got to stop and cry now, okay? Isn't this amazing? All of them were part of the directing group of lives who are working out the plans of God, founded upon the love of God. The Buddha and the Christ are still closely connected with and working in cooperation with the hierarchy. Hercules has gone over into Shambhala, but he still works in a basic association with the Buddha, who is one of the forces linking Shambhala and the hierarchy. Okay, any questions on this very deep little slide before, or bit of information, before I go on? Well, I don't see any hands up. That's a good sign. Y'all can still hear me, right? Hello? Am I lost?
You're here.
I hear you.
Okay. I'm having trouble with my internet today. So, question from Risa. Yes, I can hear you, Risa. Thank you very much. Okay, good. All right, then we'll move on. As usual, he starts with the presiding one. From the sacred council chamber, the great presiding one revealed to the teacher the will of what must be. Remember, will is ray one. It's connected to Pisces through Pluto, its esoteric ruler, and that was Hercules' soul. Lost he is, the presiding one tells the teacher, and found, dead yet vibrant with life. The server from Aquarius becomes the savior in Pisces and homeward turns. Now notice how effective the words are here, conveying much more than just the outer meaning, because we can tell a whole bunch just from knowing will is a ray one attribute and all of the things that that brings, knowing that the server is Aquarius, and what all of that means that we learned last month, and becoming the savior that we're going to learn about now. DK, throughout all of his books, he picks his words extremely carefully. And if any of you have been listening to Elena and the Dinah webinars that she's giving, she is very good at pointing that out. And that's what makes rereading them so rewarding, because The first time we read them, we don't know and understand a lot, but we gain some knowledge. And every time we reread them, we've picked up on more and more, and so the little nuances mean more and more to us. Okay, the teacher is pondering. Then he called for Hercules. "Before the last gate now you stand," the teacher said, "one labor yet remains before the circle is complete and liberation is attained. Proceed to that dark place called Eurythia, where great illusion is enthroned, where Geron, the monster of three heads, three bodies, and six hands, is lord and king. Unlawfully, he holds a herd of dark red cattle. From Eurythia to our sacred city must you drive this herd. Beware of Eurythion, the shepherd, and his two-headed dog, Orthus." He paused. "One caution I can give," he added slowly. "Invoke the aid of Helios." And through the 12th gate, the Son of Man, who was also the Son of God, departed. In search of Geryon he went. Oops. I did not fix that slide, did I? Sorry about that. Before I send it to Brett to be posted, I will have the correct presiding. These are not the right slides. Let me try again. For those of you who want the references, this is the reference in Destiny of Nations where I talked about DK referring to him as a specific person. The rest of it pretty much comes from the labors of Hercules. Okay, this is what I was just reading to you. So, Afi is in search of Geryon. All right, and his task, to capture the red cattle belonging to Geryon. Within a temple, Hercules made offerings to Helios, the god of fire in the sun. For 7 days he meditated, and then a favor was bestowed upon him, a golden chalice fell upon the ground before his feet. He knew within himself that this bright object would enable him to cross the seas to reach the land of Eurythia. Within the safe protection of the golden chalice, he sailed across the tossing seas, far, far away to Eurythia. It didn't take him long to find the pasture of the grazing cattle. It was guarded by the shepherd Eurythion and the double-headed dog Orthus. The dog immediately attacked him when Hercules approached, but he killed him with one blow. Then Eurythion, fearful of the brave warrior who stood before him, asked that his life be spared, and Hercules conceded his request. Driving the blood-red cattle before him, Hercules turned his face towards the sacred city. Not too far in this process, he saw a distant cloud of dust that rapidly grew larger. Surmising that the monster Geryon had come in mad pursuit, Hercules turned to face his foe, who was breathing fire and flame from all three heads at once. Geryon hurled a spear at Hercules that almost hit its mark, but Hercules stepped aside agilely and evaded it. Then he let fly his own arrow, that seemed to burn the air as it was released, and it struck the monster squarely in his side and with such great impetus that it shot through all three bodies, killing Geryon. Hercules returned to his task to herd the cattle toward the sacred city. He faced difficulty again and again, and the cattle strayed often. So Hercules would have to leave the herd in search of the wanderers. Across the Alps, he drove the cattle and into Italy. On his way, wherever he found that wrong had triumphed, he dealt with powers of evil a deadly blow and righted the balance in favor of justice before moving homeward. Remember, we've seen this all along. He stopped in service in the middle of his task, of his labors, and he continues to do that according to this version of this particular myth. He faced a wrestler. He faced a giant. Beat them all. At times he lost his way, but Hercules turned back, retraced his step, and he soldiered on. Though wearied by this most exacting labor, Hercules returned home at last, his teacher awaiting him. "Welcome, O son of God, who is also a son of man," he greeted the returning warrior. "The jewel of immortality is yours. By these 12 labors have you overcome the human and put on the divine. Home you have come, no more to leave. Upon the starry firmament your name shall be inscribed, a symbol to the struggling sons of men of their immortal destiny. The human labors ended. Your cosmic task begins." And from the council chamber came the presiding one's voice, "Well done, O son of God." So that's the myth. Does anybody have any questions on that before I go on? Hold on just one second. I don't see any hands. No questions, so we can go on? Okay. Okay, as we've seen before with some of the other labors, there are several variations of the myth. We're told that there was an island where lived a human monster called Geryon with the body of 3 men. He had a herd of red cattle guarded by a shepherd and a two-headed dog. He received orders, because Pisces is always a sign of obedience, to bring these cattle across land and water to that sacred city. Okay, so here we see the power of words again. Land equals matter, and water equals emotions and desire. The sacred city, the soul, the indwelling soul. Hercules sailed to the island in a golden cup, and when he arrived there, he climbed to the top of the mountain and spent the night in prayer. In other words, he prepared via meditation, invoking his soul and the work of an initiate, which the mountaintop is the symbol. Then he killed the monsters, but did not kill the shepherd. The symbolism of the red cattle is plainly that of the lower desire, an outstanding characteristic of humanity. They are guarded by a shepherd, which is the mind, the two-headed dog representing the matter aspect, and the psychic nature. And you can see why Hercules spared the shepherd. The mind can still be the shepherd of the cattle, but the two-headed dog, the psychic emotional nature and the matter aspect, had to be deprived of any power. The shepherd still had power, something a person in incarnation will need to develop is the mind. You need to use it as the interpreter of spiritual energy from the soul. And a variation on this particular myth is that Hercules placed all of the cattle in the golden cup to sail them to the island where the sacred city was, and then offered them in sacrifice to Athena, the goddess of wisdom. So these are various different ways that the mind is a crucial part of this particular myth. We have to raise the mind from the lower concrete mind to the higher mind, to the soul, into the higher mind. And then we use that to direct our lower vehicles. Okay, before I move on to the next slide, I don't see any questions, so I'm gonna soldier on.
Okay. Yvonne has her hand up, Bill.
Oh, good.
My question is, why a golden chalice? What's that mean?
I'm going to get to that in just a little bit.
Okay.
It's basically the Holy Grail. Okay. First, let's talk about what it means to actually be a savior. You know, we throw that word around, but what does it mean? Well, first off, it's one of the key words of Pisces, right? I leave my father's home, and turning back, I save. So how is Hercules a world savior? He has had a vision of something that he has to do. He sees humanity here in this myth, owned by a monster, the threefold personality that's been united but is not yet controlled by the soul. This is actually progress, the union, the coordination of those three lower vehicles and the emergence of the personality is actually progress for us. But still more progress is needed to flood those four lower vehicles with the light of the soul. And we can see this best represented in the story of Jesus. He was a human being. He was in rapport with his soul. And like Hercules, he became a transmitter of light to the sons of men. He became an example of how we all can become those transmitters of light. Eventually, as we all follow their footsteps on the path, we can envision the concept of humanity as a whole, with all minds held steady in the light, transmitting to the lower kingdoms in nature that spiritual energy which will raise them up into heaven. It is the work of humanity. That's why we're here. So we are occupied with our own problems at first, but we should never forget the larger picture. Remember, in this particular myth, the form aspect was killed. The unlawful keeper of the cattle was killed. But the shepherd and the cattle themselves were redeemed and were raised up, Yvonne, in that golden cup. This is, as I just said a minute ago, the Holy Grail. It's the most exalted symbol, and so the work was accomplished. The world savior had fulfilled his function. He had lifted up humanity. He had exposed that soul within him. This is what all world saviors have done. This is, to a great extent, the Christ did. If you followed earlier in the progress, Hercules came first. Humanity was not all that advanced, and Hercules was the forerunner, but he still had things that he couldn't accomplish because nobody in humanity had gotten that far. Then the Buddha came, and he accomplished so much, but he was a forerunner for the Christ. And then remember, with the Christ, he was the perfected one, right? So as humanity progresses, well, let's put it this way, humanity progresses just as man does, one step at a time. And as we come back several incarnations from now, we're a better person than we were before. And humanity does that same thing. It goes through those same steps. The work is slow and plodding for world saviors, but time means nothing to them. The term world savior has until now been associated with the thought of the emergence of a great Son of God out of the Father's home, called by the need of humanity to do a great work. And down the ages they have come. They've dwelt in physical bodies, they've worked through an emotional nature, and have been exceedingly intelligent. They have set examples for us with their lives so that we may follow in their footsteps. Their words have sounded the note, the message that humanity needed in order to take the immediate next step forward for humanity at that particular time. In their acts, they have given a demonstration of service, and they have gone about the world doing good. Their names have stayed with us down the ages, remembered in the minds of men for thousands of years. Not like some folks that we know who are great right now, but then pass on, and 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, their name's forgotten. These guys' names have persisted for thousands of years. Alice Bailey speculates in her lecture that this labor has actually not yet been completed, that this accomplishment lies ahead, and that humanity, the human monster, is now ready for salvation and the real work of the world savior. That's embodied as a whole with the group concept that underlies the work rather than individual soul saving. In other words, the group is important, not the individual. This is all about the waning of the Piscean Age and the waxing of the Aquarian Age, both led by the same world teacher, the Lord Maitreya. She also speculated, and I had a question on this earlier, she also speculated in another lecture that no actual person taking a physical form embodying the world savior would come. Rather, he would work through a very potent group. And then she tells us all about the new group of world servers. It actually existed in her time, and she tells us the group first needs to learn to recognize the new note as it comes from disciples wherever they're found, and secondly, to fit themselves to become part of that group. In other words, we all need to learn to work within the group, to work with the group purpose. This is carried forward from the Aquarius lesson, and is going to be a very necessary for the upcoming Aquarian Age. Inclusiveness, universality, identification with the whole and the oneness with all fellow men. The hallmark of the new group of world servers is not self-assertiveness. They are too busy doing salvage work to think about themselves. They work through meditation, keeping them in touch with the soul, and therefore in touch with the great life, the world savior, who pours his force and energy through them and toward the world. They orient their minds in that direction and serve intelligently, but are not in a hurry. Remember, this takes time, eons. The message that comes to them from the inner side is couched in the symbolic words, "What I tell you in the dark, that speak you in the light." Each one will be told a different thing according to the need of the people around him, and will deliberately go into the dark in order to deliver this message of light. Therefore, they are tied by no dogmas or doctrine, because they have the world which they have wrought out for themselves in the strife and stress of their own souls. They meet the need of their fellow men, and theirs is the message of Christ. A new commandment I give you, that you love one another. This isn't a sentiment, it's a way of life. Let us be loving and kind. Just decent behavior. The love to Christ enunciated is an intelligent understanding and appreciation of the need of the individual just as you find them. Not how you want them to be, not how you want to mold them or change them, but as they are. When you are up against the desperate need of people, you have no time to think about how to be loving in the usual sense. What you need to do is try to create an atmosphere around yourself that helps them think through in their own way to their own solution. Guide them. Point them in the right direction. But it's their solution. As long as you are occupied with being loving, then you're really occupied with your own personality. How shall we fit ourselves to meet that requirement, to possess those characteristics which automatically put us into this group of New World servers? You're never going to get there by talking about it or a theoretical appreciation of the problem. You will get there by doing the very next thing you need to do and doing it correctly. Whatever your duty is and the environment you find yourself, do it. Cultivate the right inner attitude and be wide open to all of your fellow men. Learn to meditate. Meditation, when rightly carried forward, is hard mental work, for it means orienting the mind to the soul. It means that when you have learned to focus your mind on the soul, you must hold it steady in that light. And when you have learned to do that, you must learn to listen to your mind, to what the soul is telling you. Then you must learn to take what the soul has told you and form it into words and phrases and throw it down into your waiting brain. We get a whole heck of a lot more at a soul level than we actually bring down to consciousness. We have to bring that down into consciousness. That's what meditation is. And it's by following that process that you will become a world server. For you will then be the force behind what you need to accomplish. You will automatically find yourself overshadowed by that great one whose mission it is to lift humanity out of the darkness and into the light. From the unreal into the real. Now, earlier I mentioned that statement about that Alice Bailey thought that he would not actually come as an actual person. In the Labors of Hercules, all of this came from the Labors of Hercules, this particular myth. When Alice Bailey made her statement in 1936, when she gave these lectures about Christ not coming in a physical body, it appears to have been the inner ashramic view that the status of humanity as a whole would not permit more than an overshadowing. That was what the situation was in 1936. And that was what she got from her meditation. Okay? But then when the reappearance of the Christ, which was dictated by the Tibetan in 10 years later, 1948, after the Second World War, so much had changed. The discipline of the war, the destruction of material values, the suffering and the mental growth of humanity had actually produced an effect which we are told exceeded the expectations of the hierarchy for humanity at that particular time. In Reappearance of the Christ, the following statements are found. The point of decision, as it is called in all hierarchical circles, was reached during the period of the full moon of June 1936 and the full moon of June 1945. The point of decision covered, therefore, 9 years, a relatively brief time. It resulted in the decision arrived at by the Christ to reappear or return to visible presence on earth as soon as possible and considerably earlier than had been planned. So this is an absolutely remarkable thing that we're told here, that humanity could and did impact the time and the manner of the reappearance of the Christ by a change in its receptivity. We have repeatedly been told that only humanity could condition these points, that humanity was the one who had to be ready to receive the Christ when he returns. And here we're told that that process has actually been speeded up. So that's what I've got on this particular slide. Are there any questions? Hands up. I see something blinking here. I think there's some things going out in the background, but I think we're all good to go. Nobody has any questions before I move on? No hands up? No. Okay, I'll just move right along here. I hope you're just awed by how good this is. Okay, the journey. The sign Pisces marks a triangular place in the heavens, a symbol of reality. This sign rules the feet, and hence the idea of treading the path and attaining the goal has been the underlying spiritual revelation of the Piscean Age. Pisces is also the sign of death in various aspects, the death of the body, or it might be of an old foolishness, undesirable friendships that might cease, devotion to some religious form or thought that is now ending. It can be many things. It is the sign of death to the personality. If we see the reality through the personality veils that always confuse us, then we can let it go. It means the death of a world savior, for it is the sign of crucifixion and marks the end of a zodiacal cycle. There are three signs of salvation in the zodiac. First, there's Leo, where the word goes out to the human being, work out your own salvation. The man determined to stand on his own legs, he becomes egocentric and assertive, all necessary to salvation, because only by trying out his own equipment will he arrive at the point where he gets a broader perspective. The second sign of salvation is Sagittarius, the sign of service and silence, where the assertive man, tired of talking of himself and pushing himself forward, he finally loses sight of himself in the goal and he silently serves. Then we come to this third sign, Pisces, that of the world saviors. As we talked about before, this labor brings Hercules, that most exalted symbol, the Holy Grail. Light of the Soul, page 227, the object of human evolution is to bring the Christ force into full manifestation upon the physical plane through the lower vehicles, serving as the receiver and container of the life of God. There's this great mantra, it's in the back of Raisin Initiation, page 768, which I have right here. So you can look it up later. I'm not going to read it to you. That relates the chalice, or the Holy Grail, to the egoic lotus and the unfurling of the jewel in the lotus, which is the symbol of finding the Holy Grail. It ends with this short passage. But forth from the fourfold fire, up from the altar of the ages, springs the liberated one, the flame. Back to the fire of cosmos springs the dual flame. Into the three is absorbed the essence and becomes the one with its source. The spark becomes the flame. The flame becomes the fire and form part of the great cosmic blaze that holds the secret of the five hidden within the heart. And this fits with what we're told earlier about Hercules, his mission here done, that he's moving onward and upward. That's what this is describing here. The unfurling of all of the petals, the unfurling of the jewel in the lotus, the initiation achieved. That's just our hurdles that we have to go through. But everything continues on. Hercules was tested over and over again as his lower nature was refined and redeemed. Those were the lower three. His personality, the fourth, gave way to the soul, and he became a server, and then the savior, and was finally told by his teacher that his human labors had ended and his cosmic task now begins. Questions, comments on that? Okay. So, I've gone through this each time with you. These are found in the back portion of the Labors of Hercules. They're given for each sign. The symbol is the fish. It's a water sign, Aries, Cancer, and Scorpio, and it's all about duality. In Aries, we had the duality that was attached to bringing together spirit and matter in a creative activity of manifestation. That was the beginning of the cycle. And then it culminates in Pisces, where we have the fusion, or the blending of the soul and the form, producing the manifestation of that incarnated Christ, the perfected individual soul. And so the greater and the lesser polar opposites, the human being and the God, the microcosm and the macrocosm, they're all brought to their destined expression and manifestation in this same way. Three characteristics of Pisces are captivity, renunciation, and sacrifice or death. In the first cycle of experience upon the wheel, the soul itself, this slide, this information is found in Labors of Hercules, the back of the book for every single one of the signs. What I'm reading to you now actually comes from Esoteric Astrology, beginning the Pisces portion, beginning on page 115, although there's some other things about Pisces interspersed with some of the other signs, but anyway, sorry. Three characteristics of Pisces are captivity, renunciation, and sacrifice. In the first cycle of experience upon the wheel, the soul itself is in captivity to substance. It has come down into the prison of matter and linked itself to form, as we see with the symbol of Pisces, the two fish linked together by a band. One fish stands for the soul and the other for the personality or the form nature. And between them is to be found the thread or sutratma, the silver cord, which keeps them bound to each other throughout the cycle of manifestation. In other words, the whole cycle of all the various incarnations until they become perfected. Later on, upon the reversed wheel, the personality is brought into captivity by the soul. But for eons, the situation was reversed, and the soul was the prisoner of the personality. This dual bondage is brought to an end by what is called the final death, when the complete release of the life aspect from the life of form takes place. This is what happened to Hercules in this labor. He finally brought the personality under captivity of the soul. Like Hercules, people born in Pisces are frequently to be found serving the race and ministering to its needs upon some level of consciousness. Thus they are prepared for the final sacrifice in Pisces, which absorbs them back into their originating motive, back into their father's home. DK tells us that the old commentary expresses it in this particular phrase. It is for this reason that the life of service and the directed intention to serve constitute a scientific method. of achieving release. In Aquarius, the sign of world service, the lesson is finally learned, which produces the world savior in Pisces. And so the constant emphasis on service we hear about all the time. It is also interesting to look at the rays which express themselves through the planetary rulers, which absorb or collaborate with the influence of the sign of Pisces and influence our planet and humanity. Two major rays express themselves through the rulers of Pisces. The first ray of will or power focused through Pluto, the esoteric ruler, and the second ray of love, wisdom, through both the sign Pisces and the exoteric ruler, Jupiter. Well, it was the ruler prior to Neptune being discovered. But it still has a great impact, okay? Their interplay, the first and second ray working together, produce the duality of this sign. They bring about the major problems of Pisces, like psychic sensitivity. They cause the lure of the path. First, it was the path of evolution, mired us in matter, and then the lure of the probationary path, the return, the evolution back to our source. It precipitates the process of transmutation and the eventual escape through death. Unfolds the significance, activity, and beauty of death and the work of the destroyer. From this, it will be apparent how important and powerful Pisces is. Through its orthodox ruler, Jupiter, that force is brought to bear, which brings all together, and in this case, relates the two fish and binds them together in a functioning relationship. That's the activity of Ray 2, which relates the soul and form, and brings the two together in Pisces. From another angle, in a dual sign, this can also be seen working out for us in Gemini. In Pisces, there is demonstrated the captivity angle, the relationship to the two fish holding each other captive and unable to escape. And in Gemini, it's a relationship between the two brothers, but there is no connecting band there. And in that relationship, it is latent free choice and free determination. In connection with the lesser duality found in every human being, that of the head and the heart, of the mind and love, the will and wisdom, the work of Jupiter is to develop those qualities and to bring them into synthetic interplay. Eventually, there has to be the complete fusion of love and mind before a world savior can manifest and function efficiently. And this is preeminently the final result of the forces of the mutable cross as they work out the qualities released by the planets active in Pisces, Sagittarius, Virgo, and Gemini. That is the orthodox planets, Jupiter and Mercury, for all four of those signs, or the esoteric planets, Pluto, the Earth, the Moon, hiding Vulcan, and Venus. As you know, Pluto stands for death, or the region of death, the Earth stands for the sphere of experience, the Moon or Vulcan stands for glorification through purification and detachment of matter, and Venus stands for the emergence of the love principle through the directing power of the mind. Orthodox astrology assigns only two planets to these four signs, which indicates a definite interplay. Jupiter, the way of incarnation, is beneficent method of evolutionary unfoldment. Mercury, the line of least resistance, harmony through conflict. So that brings in the second and the fourth ray with those two rulers. Ray 4, Mercury, is Buddhic, intuitional, and it's expressive of the Christ as Mercury and the Sun are considered one. But the esoteric planets are more explicit in their inferences. When man is ready for those influences, he needs to be responsive to the fourfold way through Venus, under the power of the mind, transmuted into wisdom, through the instrument of love, through the moon, under the bondage of form, in order to form experience and achieve release and uplift matter. That's not in Vulcan. Through the earth, under the influence of planetary experience, which is different individual experience, in order to transmute personal consciousness into group awareness. And through Pluto, under the destroying power, the death of desire, death of the personality, and all which holds him between the pairs of opposite, in order to achieve the final liberation. Pluto or death never destroys the consciousness aspect. Just the matter aspect. It's interesting to note that the three signs of death are found in three different crosses: Aries, the cardinal cross; Scorpio, the fixed cross; and Pisces, the mutable cross. It is the influence of these three which brings about the three needed and determined deaths in the life of the human being. DK says he's here referring to the signs independently of the planetary rulers. There is something in the energy which pours in through these signs, which predominates a crystallizing process and the eventual destruction of some type of form control. There's the death by drowning or water in Pisces that releases man again into the great center, which we call humanity. Death by suffocation in Scorpio releases man into the planetary center, which we call hierarchy. And death by fire or burning in Aries releases man into another center, that which we call Shambhala. There is another point in connection with planetary influence I want to mention here, because its emphasis it emphasizes the synthetic position of Virgo, the opposite of Pisces, and its contribution as a major focal point for the distribution of energy to the fourth creative hierarchy, humanity. Jupiter rules four signs, and each of them represent the different element, one of four each, which express themselves in the three world of human evolution. So what we see is Jupiter is the conveyor of expansion. In Virgo, Earth, it's the hidden Christ. In Pisces, water, it's the hidden savior. In Sagittarius, fire, it's the hidden master. And in Aquarius, air, it's the hidden server. Okay? Any questions, comments before I move on to the next slide? Okay, just a quick recap of what the water signs are. It's emotional, nurturing, conforming, but they can be too sensitive. Esoterically, there are keys to purification and identification. Cancer, purified waters of experience and identification with the masses. Scorpio, purified waters of test, identifying with the hierarchy. Pisces, purified daily life, identification with the spirit. They are feminine, like the earth signs are, passive, receptive, containing. They represent the night, and for the most part are related to the 2-4-6 ray line. Cancer is actually on the 3rd and 7th ray line, but its rulers are 4th ray, so that falls in line there too. They are compatible with earth signs, and they work out those particular issues as the relationship between the axis and through trines and sextiles, which are favorable aspects. I only got a couple more to make it through here. Okay, we've seen this before too. Recap of the mutable signs. This is the end, this is the last one, so I want to be sure that I capture all of this here. Okay. They're adaptable, versatile, and serving. They can be inconsistent, and they work out, this is the squares, these work out via the oppositions and squares, which are the hard aspects. The crosses are never easy. The form life is developed through incarnation, you can see here, Gemini, control of the opposites, Virgo, nurturing the soul and the heart, Sag, one-pointed aspiration, Pisces, developing self-consciousness. The synthesized axis eventually will work out. Gemini, Sagittarius, establishing control of the opposites and resolving the duality into at-one-ment for spiritual use. Virgo, Pisces, nurturing the soul within the heart and bringing it into conscious manifestation. When the individual man enters upon his cycle of incarnation and emerges in the sign of Cancer, which is found on the cardinal cross, that's the gate into incarnation. Then he metaphorically mounts the mutable cross, and his long term of imprisonment in form begins. He goes on learning until he has transformed servitude into service. He alternates between the pairs of opposite, both from the astral emotional angle and from the point of view of the four arms of the mutable cross. Unevolved man, Gemini, changeable instability interplay. Sagittarius, ambitious desire, direction, orientation. Virgo, material life, the cherishing of an idea. Pisces, sensation, mediumship, fluidity. This experience on the mutable cross lasts a very long time, carries man always back again and again into the sphere of influence of Aries, which through ruling activity of the first ray both strengthens the will and the man, no matter what his ray, and ends cycle after cycle with the word of destruction. Again and again he enters into the sign Pisces and finds his way around the great wheel until the experience of change and of mutability and the establishment of transmutation process carry his consciousness from the instinctual and intellectual stages to the faint beginnings of the intuitive process of Gemini. Then comes the great process of polarization and a moment of transference where the influence of the fixed cross causes the reversal and the lessons gained on the mutable cross have to be worked out, the effects that are demonstrated on the fixed cross. Remember last time I told you it's the wheel turning in against the wheel. We're still going through exoterically the wrong way as esoterically we begin to go the right way. And that's what causes all of the heartache and tests and trials and crises of the disciple on the fixed cross. But we're talking about the mutable cross here now. So evolved man, going through the signs in the right order and having learned thousands of years of experience going the wrong way, now experiences Gemini as recognition of soul in form and the soul interplay. Sagittarius is that one-pointed spiritual aspiration of disciples. Virgo is the mother of that Christ child, the gestation period of the Christ. And Pisces becomes the world savior and the mediatorship, mediator instead of the medium. Any questions before I quickly go through these next couple of slides? Okay, so far so good. So, what did Hercules do? He set out confidently, didn't realize the magnitude of the task, and he was actually unprepared for failure. But he did not always succeed. He failed, he had to redo some, and he finished some, but did it badly. He was still susceptible to glamour and illusion. But he is solidly on the path of discipleship and set on performing those 12 acts of service for humanity, which he eventually did. Again, the link between the myth and the sign. By combining the astrological knowledge that we have that we're given in esoteric astrology with the symbolic story that we're giving in the labors of Hercules, we can see the tests of everyday life of a disciple and also of an ordinary man. We see this via the sign in which the myth takes place. Each sign subjects the disciple to certain distinctive forces and provides him with certain tendencies and opportunities. And when this is understood, it helps all of us, no matter what level we're at, because there's knowledge in there for all of us at every single step that we take. And so we saw the progress. There were the four prep signs, equipped with mind in Aries, desire in Taurus, duality in Gemini, human kingdom in Cancer. Then there were the four signs of physical plane struggle. Self-consciousness and individualism in Leo, nurturing the Christ within in Virgo, balancing the pairs of opposites in Libra, and overcoming illusion in Scorpio, and finally the four signs of achievement. Straight for the goal in Sag, scaling the mountain of initiation in Capricorn, the world server in Aquarius, culminating finally in the world savior in Pisces. And I'd like to just really quickly go through again why we study the Hercules myth. Progress of Hercules from the mental plane through the emotional plane and out into the physical plane shows us a synthetic picture of the work done by every person. It's arduous, slow, and carried forward under great difficulties, sometimes in blind ignorance, but we do it. We achieve self-knowledge and development and experience as we do it. Character and nature are tested and tried until the qualities which characterize the form can be transmuted into those which reveal the soul. Okay. That about wraps up what I've got for you today on this. I want to thank every single one of you for participating in Hercules' journey, whether it was one webinar or all of them. This is the final one. I hope that all of you will want to revisit the myth by rereading the book, or you can revisit. We've recorded all of these sessions, and they're available at this particular link. When Brett posts this, adds it to that particular link, he will also add my slides, so you don't have to be, you know, madly copying down links here. The Hercules set of webinars was not the only ones we have out there. We've got some great ones that other faculty members have been doing, and they're all available at that same link. And we also have ongoing ones. They're going on all the time. This one's going to stop, but some other people are going to pick up and do some other ones. And if you go to our external website, moirafederation.com, you can see all kinds of things. But if you go to the tab on our webinar courses, it'll give you the opportunity there to sign up so that you get our newsletters and so that you hear about all of the webinars that we've got going and have the opportunity to sign up and join them like you did with this one. So, that wraps up what I've got here. Does anybody have any questions or any comments? You guys were a really silent bunch. Okay, well, unless, oh, I see a question. Maria, oh, wait a minute. I got a couple of them here. Stephen says, thank you for sharing your time and efforts integrating the information. I appreciate it. Maria says, a beautiful and illustrative presentation of the labors of Hercules and Pisces. Thank you. Thanks. Michelle says, thanks for a wonderful woman. Well, thank you, guys. I'm glad. A hand. Yay. Go ahead, Malia.
I simply want to echo the what people have said in their written remarks. Beautifully clear. I mean, so clear that there was no need to ask questions because you anticipated the questions and answered them right away. So I just really appreciate it and thank you so much for all the work in this.
Well, thank you to all of you for that. And I have to say, I've anticipated the questions because I've learned. This is the 13th one. I have evolved. My first ones weren't quite as polished. And I also had a lot of help with individuals who, through the series, have sent in their questions. So I appreciate the interactivity. That's why we do them on the webinars, is so that we have this interactivity. So thank you all for attending, and I guess we're done then. Thank you guys, Brett, Joe, and Kay, for helping me out. Thanks, Risa.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a real pleasure, Leo.
Thank you, Leo.
All good. Thank you.